1 Samuel records the establishment of Israel's monarchy. Samuel served Israel faithfully as prophet, priest, and judge, and was directed by God to anoint Israel's first king, Saul, the king the people demanded. After Saul turned from God, David was anointed by Samuel to succeed Saul, thus establishing God's king, which paved the way for the eternal kingdom of Jesus.
Awesome. 1 Samuel chapter 29. 1 Samuel chapter 29. It is good to be with you. I'm going to do this a little bit as I do this. You can find it. We are almost done. Almost done. 1 Samuel 29, 30, then 31. Somebody asked me if we're doing 2 Samuel right after 1st. No. Not that there's anything wrong with 2 Samuel. We're just going to take a break from the mayhem and all of that stuff from 1 Samuel. It's been a good ride, but we are going to be done here in a couple weeks. Then we'll get into summer, John 17, during much of the summer, not all of it, much of the summer. And then the book of Acts starting in September after we launch a new year then. 1 Samuel 29. We were interrupted last week. Don't know if you remember that. If you were here last week, we were interrupted. If you remember what we were interrupted from, well, you can look back at chapter 28, verses 1 and 2. That's the dilemma of David. I've talked much about that. It's in verse 2 that the author chooses to just shut things down, interrupt us, and has us focus on something far more pressing. At least that's how I argued for it last week. Far more pressing. And that was the dilemma that Saul found himself in. And what was that more pressing dilemma that he found himself in? He had an incapability of hearing from God. And that was last week. But today we are back to our regularly scheduled program. Now, a quick reminder for those of you who maybe haven't been around for a few weeks and you're not really sure what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the dilemma that David finds himself in. If you remember back to chapter 27, David chose to go down to the land of the Philistines, reasoning correctly that if he went down to the land of the Philistines, Saul would not follow him there. Now, why would he feel that? Well, because Saul's a chicken. I know that's not biblical. Saul's fearful, okay? He's fearful. He's demonstrated that. Anytime a big event comes on where Saul has to do something warrior-like, he gets freaked out. He gets scared. David, I think, surmised at least somewhat because of that, that if he went down to this enemy territory, Saul would not come after him. And he rightly concluded that. Saul did not follow him there. But as I also argued, as I looked back at that in chapter 27, I argue that this was a faithless decision on David's part. It was faithless. I think it was a decision that was angst-filled. And however understandable it might have been, it was a wrong decision. That's what I argued for a couple of weeks ago. And I believe this is evidenced in several ways. One of the ways that I think it's evidenced itself in the life of David is what he did for 16 months when he went down to the land of the Philistines. He lied. He was full of deceit. He covered his butt by doing some very horrific things, if you remember. What David did when he went down to the land of the Philistines is he deceived a man named Achish. Achish is the king of the Philistines. He lied to Achish and said, "Achish, I am raiding, taking care of the enemies of Israel, or excuse me, the enemies of Israel and their allies while I'm down here." And he duped Achish into believing that. When in fact, what he was doing is he was, as a good Israelite warrior and the future king of Israel would do, he was taking care of those enemies and allies, right, that were raiding against Israel. He was taking on the enemies of Israel, but Achish was duped by him. Now, as we come to chapter 29, this is the context that we walk into. Achish and the Philistines are now rallying and going up into and fighting against the Israelites. And Achish is so bought into the duping of David that he just assumes that he will fight on their behalf. So he calls in his markers, right? He's let David hang out here. He's given him his own city, Ziklag, right? I mean, he gave him the city of Ziklag. And so now he's just assuming, because what? David's been fighting against the Israelites and their allies all along. He would just naturally join us. And so David is called to join him. This is David, as I've argued over the last couple of weeks, between a rock and a very hard place. Does he walk right back into the throes of Saul? Because Saul wants him killed, right? He's got 3,000 of his best minions, right? The bounty hunters, the best of the best running after David. Does David choose to go up into the land of Israel, walking right back into the hornet's nest? Or does he tell Achish of his deceit and have Achish ticked off? Thus, two different groups, right? Two different nations, two different marauding groups of men that want David killed. What's David going to do? How's he going to get out of this mess? That's where we were interrupted. So let's pick things up in chapter 29, verses. We're going to read verses 1 to halfway through verse 3. You guys good today?
Oh, yeah.
You good? You seem quiet. You like second gathering. Second gathering is quiet, man. Second gathering is quiet. Like I can, man, quiet. Quiet makes me nervous. Makes me nervous when they're so quiet. Don't be, makes me nervous. Right? It's like being on a blind date, right? Big tuna hanging off your tooth, right? Like, maybe a piece of tuna. It was a big tuna. And you didn't notice. That'd be a problem there because they're big fish. All right, let's read the first 2.5 verses. That's rabbit trail. That's a, all right, here we go. Verse 1, now the Philistines, dirty Philistines, had gathered all their forces at Aphek, and the Israelites were encamped by the spring that is in Jezreel. As the lords of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were passing on in the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines said, what are these Hebrews doing here? That's a good question. What are these guys here for? I mean, I don't know what a good illustration. I tried to come up with a good illustration. I don't know how good it is, but let's just imagine the U.S. Army going into fight Iraq. And they're presenting all of their battalions before they go over and fight Iraq. Right? All in their pomp and circumstance. They're parading. Everybody's watching this. Battalion, battalion, battalion. Troop, troop, troop. Here comes the last battalion. Here comes the last troop. They're going into fight Iraq. And this last troop is a group of Iraqi men led by Saddam Hussein. You'd be like, what the, right? The parade would get really quiet. That's kind of what's going on here. Why are these guys with us? What are they doing here? We're going into Israel. Here's the next king of Israel with a bunch of Israelites, and they're following behind us. This is nuts. So what does Achish, the king, try to do? He tries to smooth things over. Look at halfway through verse 3. Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who's been with me now for days and years, and since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day. I mean, again, Achish is totally bought into what David's about. But in spite of Achish's plea, the commanders of the army want nothing to do with him. Look at verses 4 and 5. The commanders of the Philistines were angry with Achish. And the commanders of the Philistines said to him, send the man back, that he may return to the place to which you have assigned him. He shall not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his Lord? Speaking of Saul, how could he reconcile himself to the Lord, his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Is this not David, of whom they sing to one another in dances? Saul struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. I don't know how you sing that, by the way. Right? No, that's how they raved back then, right? Dances. And if you can put it to a good beat, we'll sing it here because it's Bible. But this is what's going on. Okay, the commanders of the Philistines, this is David Achish. They write folk songs about this guy. He's going to be the next king. He kills 10,000. Saul, the guy we're going to battle, he kills thousands. What it'll do possibly is we'll go into battle with him covering the flank and he'll quickly turn on us. And why will he quickly turn on them? They surmise. I think two reasons. One is because he's an Israelite, they think he's going to turn on us. But I think more than that, what they suggest is he will try to make himself look okay and right in Saul's eyes again by turning on us, becoming our adversary, and taking us down at our heads. Saul will look at this and go, well, I guess David's on our team again. Because right now he's still nervous of David. He doesn't think he's on his team. So maybe David will use this as an opportunity to make him look good in Saul's eyes again. Now, we don't know if that would take place. But if we were to ask the question, how would David get out of this rock and the hard place situation he is in? I think perhaps this is what David was thinking. I think the leaders of the Philistines guess at it. But I really do think that this was what David was probably going to do. I'll try to prove that a little bit later, even more so, but I think that's probably what he would do. He would go up and he would turn on the Philistines, taking care of them, because what has he been doing for the last 16 months? He's been warring against the enemies of Israel for the last 16 months, so I think he would just simply carry it on again, but we don't even have to guess. It's a rhetorical question, for it never came to that. Look at verses 6 and 7. Then Achish called to David and said to him, "As the Lord lives, you have been honest." It's awesome. I love that. He's so duped. "And to me, it seems right that you should march out and in with me in the campaign, for I have found nothing wrong in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, the Lords do not approve of you." The Lords meaning leadership, small L Lords. "So go back now and go peaceably, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." Verses 6 and 7 finally answer the question we've been asking for the last couple of weeks. How is David going to get out of this? Here's the answer. Achish and the commanders send him, and don't miss this, if you like underlying things, they send him peaceably back to Ziklag. Go in peace. He doesn't even have to fight. He doesn't even have to go up. He doesn't even have to be a bodyguard to Achish. He doesn't even have to run for his life from the commanders of the Philistines. Go back in peace to that city I gave you. That's amazing. David, how are you going to get out of this? I don't know. Here's how. And it's at this point that I think we can breathe a huge sigh of relief, can't we? I mean, this is absolutely great. He's free to go. I think many of us, if not most of us, would absolutely jump at this. We'd be bursting at the seams. We would be moving as fast as we can. We'd get out of there, right? He would not even have the sentence finished. We'd be busting out of there. But here's the stupid thing about David on a first read. He doesn't react like that. Look at verse 8. He's given this opportunity, rock and hard place. Hey, get out of here, go back, man, have a burger, chill out, watch the game. He doesn't. Look at verse 8. David said to Achish, "But what have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day I entered your service until now, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord, the king?" You ever been in a situation, period, I'm just kidding. That's a good question. You ever been in a situation? It's a good small group question. I just get everybody talking. You ever been in a situation, party, birthday party, get together, just a bunch of people hanging out, and the person you came with, friend, family member, spouse, child, parent, they just start talking and saying stuff that they just shouldn't be talking about. You know what I mean? Right? Stuff that's private, stuff that's embarrassing to you, stuff that should be kept between the two of you, and you just want to scream, "Shut up." You know what I'm talking about? And so you're trying to have them get quiet with your eyes, right? Your face is freaking out. You know what I mean, right? All of you know what I mean, right? The church that I used to work at, I won't tell you which one that is, but the church that I used to work at, the senior pastor there, had a hand signal for the worship pastor there if he started talking too much. Because sometimes worship pastors, they start talking a lot and they don't sing enough, right? It's like me starting to sing. You wouldn't want that. So the senior guy there, he had a hand signal and it was three fingers on his lapel and it meant literally shut up and sing. And you would watch for it. It was awesome. You would sit there, you'd start talking, and all of a sudden you're like, "Shut up and sing." It's awesome. And I think we sometimes, I mean, some couples, married couples usually, they do have some sort of hand signal, or it's a statement that just, shush, right? Shush. When I read verse 8, I want David to shut up. I know that's a bad way of saying it. We're not supposed to say shut up, I know. I want him to shush. Or hush y'all, right? We want David to be quiet. I mean, why would David push back on Achish? I mean, Dave, here's your out, man. Some suggest that he's just playing the game to its full effects. That if David quickly grabbed his stuff and started running away, it would look suspicious. So he's just playing it out. Maybe. But I think something else is going on here. I think David really wanted to go and fight. I mean, think about who the Philistines are. They are either enemy number one or 1B, between them and Amalekites, all right? They'd have different rankings that would come out every week, all right? One of them, Amalekites, Philistines, pretty much those two bands of brothers, all right? Bad news. So this is enemy one or 1B in the history of the Israelites. Babylonians, they came in a little bit later. So Babylonians, we got the Philistines, we got the Amalekites, bad news. But Philistines and Amalekites at this time, they're bad news, all right? So the Philistines, that's who's going up against who? Israel. Now, I know Saul's a bozo, and he's got bozos under him. But this is Israel. And what's David been doing for the last 16 months? He's been taking care of the enemies of Israel. Are the Philistines the enemies of Israel? Absolutely. I think David wanted to go. What would he do? Well, we've guessed, turn on the Philistines at some point. We're not sure. If something good came out of it between his relationship with Saul, a bonus. But I really think he wanted to go. I don't think he was playing a game here. And so David resists. I want to go. I want to go. But thankfully, I think, and we'll see this later, Achish is not persuaded. Look at verses 9 and 10. Achish answered David and said, I know that you are blameless, as blameless in my sight as an angel of God. So, you got to laugh at that. I mean, come on, Achish. All right? Brother. He's not a brother. He's a Philistine. Dirty Philistines. Right? Remember that. Bad. Right? Right? I always refer to who? Dwight Schrute. He didn't like the Philistines. I don't like the Philistines. All right? I know that you are as blameless in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with this, up with us to the battle. Now then rise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord who came with you and start early in the morning and depart as you have light. So David intervenes, Achish intervenes, he pushes back, says it's not going to happen. Now, I said earlier that this chapter helps answer the question we had at the end of verse 2 of chapter 28. How does David get out of this? This is how. And do you know what we conclude here? We could conclude here. Dude caught a lucky break. Right? Oh man, you're lucky. We could conclude that. Rock, hard place, what are you going to do? This happened. Wow, we use that phrase all the time. Boy, you're lucky. I mean, how lucky could you be? We use that all. But Wes, I don't think that's the point of the text. I don't think the point of chapter 29 is here just to highlight the lucky break that David caught. Instead, I think what it does is that it teaches us something about the God working within it. And I really want you to hear that because, again, I think we throw out, boy, I caught a lucky break today, a lot. And so what I want to do with you, me, is I want to highlight what we learn about God in the getting of David out of this dilemma. You with me? So maybe we can go from going, boy, I caught a lucky one today. Instead, we would say, what perhaps has God done? You understand where I'm going? Let me highlight three things that we learn about God here. Number one, God works quietly. It's the first thing that jumps out about God in this chapter. He works quietly. He's pretty quiet. Right? He is mentioned twice in chapter 29. He's mentioned both times, however, by Achish. In verse 6, he's mentioned by Achish, and the word God is connected to angel of God a little bit later. Achish is the one who talks about God. He's mentioned there by him. But why is God so quiet? And the reason why I think that's a good question is because God has not been very quiet in 1 Samuel. God's been resounding in 1 Samuel, added commentary to make sure that we know it's God working in 1 Samuel. Probably the greatest example of that is in chapter 26. Chapter 26 is when David and Abishai go down into this group of 3,000. Saul and his minion partner sleeping in the middle. They're sleeping. They go in to take a spear and a water jug. And in verse 12, we read that a deep sleep, then we get this added commentary, from the Lord had fallen upon them. So we have this act, and just to make sure we as the reader know who's working, there it is for us. But here, we don't get that added commentary. Why not? Well, we aren't told. But I think we can speculate. And I think we can speculate with some measure of assurance based on what we know of God's character displayed elsewhere. So let me just give you one reason. One reason why God chooses at times to work quietly. And I think there's a bedillion of them. There's a lot of reasons. Okay? There's a lot of reasons. But let me just give you one. Why does God choose at times to work quietly? For this reason. God works quietly because it causes us and it calls us to pursue seeing his involvement in our lives. Don't miss that. I know that sounds rather simple. I think that's significant. God chooses at times to work quietly because it causes us and it calls us to pursue seeing his involvement in our lives. But here's another question. I'm going to ask a lot of questions today. Here's another question. What keeps us from seeing that? Two big reasons. One reason is because I think there are times where God moves and works and orchestrates and we fail to see it because we just aren't looking for it. Why aren't we looking for it? Because we're just kind of doing life. We're swimming downstream. We're conforming. We're not transforming. Transforming necessitates swimming upstream. Conforming, just go with everybody. You get up, you do life. And there's nothing wrong with getting up and doing life, being faithful and such. But sometimes we can misunderstand or misequate faithfulness with, you know what, I'm just kind of in the routine. And I'm not really doing anything bad that anybody could point fingers at. But you know what, I don't really have eyes to see. But when we go upstream, turn upstream, go against the flow, you begin to notice those things before that you missed. Then secondly, I think we miss seeing things, that there are times where God's work and activity are being demonstrated and are evident, but we choose not to see them. Not that we just miss them, but we absolutely deliberately exchange, to use biblical wording, we exchange the Creator for created things. So things are going on in our lives and we just cast it off as, boy, I caught a lucky break. For example. And we forget. I was with the men yesterday, hanging out by the river. Got the van down by the river. So Chris Farley. I love Chris Farley. Live in a van down by the river. I don't know why that's bad. Rivers are nice, actually. Maybe it's the van part. I was talking about the importance. There's a lot of important things, I think, for us, both men and women, to do and remember. But one of them is remember. I gave it away there. To not forget. Because I think we have a great ease to forget. Propensity, proclivity, leaning naturally towards forgetting. We choose, we forget lots. And I think we forget for a lot of reasons. But I think one of the things that we aren't willing to talk about as much is that we will deliberately in our lives choose to forget. That it doesn't happen. We choose it. In fact, Peter writes in 2 Peter 3 of the strong connection between godlessness and the deliberate choosing to forget the workings of God in the activities around us, specifically in creation. In Romans chapter 1, it's the deliberate exchanging of the Creator God for created things that leads to the giving or handing over of God. And as I highlighted yesterday, our choosing to forget, I think, is counterbalanced by Jesus' instruction in the upper room. And what is Jesus' instruction in the upper room? Do this in remembrance of me. And the question I asked the men yesterday is, and I'm going to play the fool again here, Jesus, come on, man, how could they ever forget that? How could they forget this night? And the question I asked the men again yesterday was, let me ask you, the last time that you deliberately went out and sinned, did it come out of a great place where you were focused and remembering and meditating on the goodness of God? Or did it come from a place where you chose to forget him? Why do we remember Jesus here every week? Because we need to remember Jesus here every week. That question gives me the heebie-jeebies when I get it. Why do you do this every week? No, the ball's in your court. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? Romans 1, verses 19 and 20 says this, what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world. Where have they been perceived? In the things that have been made. I ran across this article. I'm going to take a chance and read it to you. It's a little bit lengthier. We're actually going to put it on the city because I've had a few people ax me for it. So we're going to put it on there. Thank you for listening. This article that I came across is based out of what you can see there from Job. That's actually Romans 1, I think. My eyes are bad, but that's Romans 1. Job 5, verses 8 to 10, records the words of Job. He writes, says, as for me, I would seek God, and to God would I commit my cause. Who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number? He gives rain on the earth and sends waters on the fields. Let me pick up the words of the individual writing this article. If you said to someone, my God does great and unsearchable things, he does wonders without number, and they responded, really, like what? Would you say, like rain? I mean, in our city, we'd be like, my God, man, he loves our city, man. I mean, the goodness of God on Vancouver is unbelievable. I'll pick up what he writes. When I read these verses from Job recently, I felt at first the way I did on hearing some bad poetry that went something like this. Let me suffer, let me die, just to win your hand. Let me even climb a hill or walk across the land. Even? I would suffer and die to have your hand and even walk across the land? As if walking across the land were more sacrificial than dying? This sounded to me like a joke. But Job is not joking. God does great and unsearchable things, wonders without number. He gives rain on the earth. In Job's mind, rain really is one of the great unsearchable wonders that God does. So when I read this a few weeks ago, I resolved not to treat it as a meaningless pop musical lyric. I decided to have a conversation with myself, which is what I mean by meditation. Is rain a great and unsearchable wonder wrought by God? Picture yourself as a farmer in the Near East, far from any lake or stream. A few wells keep the family and animals supplied with water, but if crops are to grow and the family is to be fed from month to month, water has to come from another source on the fields. From where? Well, the sky. The sky? Water will come out of the clear blue sky? Well, not exactly. Water will have to be carried in the sky from the Mediterranean Sea over several hundred miles and then be poured out on the fields from the sky. Carried? How much does it weigh? Well, if 1 inch of rain falls on 1 square mile of farmland during the night, that would be 27,878,400 cubic feet of water, which is 206,300,160 gallons, which is 1,650,501,280 pounds of water. Vancouver's a heavy city. It's a heavy city. It's a lot of weight. So how does it get up in the sky and stay up there if it's so heavy? Well, it gets up there by evaporation. Really? That's a nice word. What does it mean? It means that the water stops being water for a while so it can go up and not down. I see. Then how does it get down? Well, then condensation happens. What is that? The water starts becoming water again by gathering around little dust particles between 0.00001 and 0.0001 centimeters wide. that small. What about the salt? Salt? Yes. The Mediterranean Sea is salt water. That would kill the crops. What about the salt? Well, the salt has to be taken out. Oh? So the sky picks up 1 billion pounds of water from the sea, takes out the salt, carries the water, or whatever it is when it's not water, for 300 miles, and then dumps it, now turned into water again on the farm. Well, yes, it doesn't dump. If it dumped 1 billion pounds of water on the farm, the wheat would be crushed. So the sky dribbles 1 billion pounds of water down in little drops. And they have to be big enough to fall for 1 mile or so without evaporating, but small enough to keep from crushing the wheat stalk. So how do all these microscopic specks of water that weigh 1 billion pounds get heavy enough to fall, if that's the way to ask the question? Well, it's called coalescence. What's that? It means that the specks of water start bumping into each other and join up and get bigger and bigger. And when they are big enough, they fall just like that. Well, not exactly, because they would just bounce off each other instead of joining up if there was no electric field present. What? Never mind. Take my word for it. I think instead I will take Job's word for it. I still don't see why drops ever get to the ground, because if they start falling as soon as they are heavier than air, they would be too small not to evaporate on the way down. But if they wait to come down, what holds them up till they are big enough not to evaporate? Yes, I am sure there's a name for that too. But I am satisfied for now that by any name, this is a great and unsearchable thing that God has done. I think we should be thankful, lots more thankful than I am. God often works quietly, but don't equate quietly with the insignificant. Here's the second thing we learn about God in chapter 29. God works surprisingly. Don't you like the surprising acts of God? God works surprisingly. Let me ask you a question. Who does God use to get David out of his dilemma? It's the commanders of the Philistines. In fact, if it was up to Achish, David would still have gone into battle. But in verse 3, the commanders step in, as we saw. They're angry. They're ticked at Achish, and they tell him that David has to go. By the way, this isn't, if you've been around for a while, this isn't the first time that God has used the Philistines to save David, by the way. We saw this back in chapter 23, for example, when David is on the run. He's about to get captured, and this messenger came and tells Saul that the Philistines were raiding their land. And so Saul turns around and goes back. God uses David's enemies to bring salvation. And Westside, God does that more often than you and I may have considered before. In Genesis, God uses Joseph's brothers for the saving of many lives. In Habakkuk, God uses the Babylonians to bring judgment on Israel. In Matthew and Luke, God uses Herod to bring about the fulfillment of much prophecy regarding the coming Messiah. And on Good Friday, God used the hands of lawless men to crucify Jesus. But can I ask you, do you think the brothers, Joseph's brothers, knew they were being used? Do you think the Babylonians knew they were being used? Do you think Herod knew he was being used? Do you think the lawless men knew they were being used? No, but God was using them according to his definite plan and foreknowledge. So let me just break here. I got a little more time. I like the third. Some of you are so scared of making a wrong decision that it cripples you. If I go left and God wants me to go right, God is screwed and so am I. Right? Or I went left and I knew I should have gone right and I met that going left and I've really made a mess of my life and it's way too big for God. Can I free you from that a little bit? That God can work surprisingly. And let me even put it a little bit farther. And this is not freedom. Please don't use this grace of God as freedom to sin. But at times, God works in surprising ways. When we should have gone right, we went left. And he intervenes and it demonstrates even in grander ways his being God. I want you to be free from this crippling that so affects us. I like what Paul writes in Romans 11:33. Paul's awesome. I'm a big Paul guy. And I'm a big Romans guy. In Romans 11:33, Paul's writing about the story of the history of the salvation of God. And he's writing to his Jewish brethren who are really confused, ticked, angry, upset about Jesus, about the Gentiles coming in, grafting in. He's like, they're like, what? And Paul's explaining the salvation story of Jesus and about how God from the beginning of time is orchestrating, and here's the coming together. And it's so absolutely wondrous, even though it's bewildering. And he gets to verse 33 and he's writing, he's sort of his doxology of chapter 11, and he writes, oh, I mean, when you write, oh, right? I mean, we say, oh, but how many times have you been, oh, and you have to write it? Like, that's awesome, right? Oh, I got to write it. Oh, right? Don't miss that, right? That's a good oh. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments or decisions, and how inscrutable his ways. I got more time. Hang around. Go to Acts 9. I'll go to Acts. I didn't do this in the first two. This is a freebie for you. I'm talking about how God works surprisingly, right? Uses the Babylonians, and he uses the brothers of Joseph and lawless men. And but who did he use to absolutely spread the gospel message of Jesus in the story of the early church? Saul, who became Paul. I mean, take a look. Chapter 9 is awesome in Acts. I mean, all of Acts is great. All of the Bible is great. But Acts chapter 9. We're going to have a good time going through Acts. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be great. But look in verses 13 and 14. This is when God, through a vision to Ananias, comes and says, hey, I've got my man now. It's Saul. Saul's gonna bring leadership. And just take a look at verses 13 and 14. But Ananias answered. This is a great answer. He fills God in on some things. This is great. Lord, I have heard from many about this man, and perhaps you've missed some things, right? How much evil he has done to your saints at Jerusalem. And here he has authority from the chief priests to bind all who call on your name. Doesn't get much more surprising than this. I've called Saul, who became Paul. Saul scattered the early church in Acts chapter 8, right? Killed Stephen, they scatter. Chapter 9, he's saved and he's called to disciple the first scatterers. Our God. Oh, how unsearchable are his ways. He works surprisingly. And lastly, he works tenaciously. I like the word tenacious. You like the word tenacious? It's a good tenacity. It's a good. That should be a name for one of the teams on Celebrity Apprentice. Team Tenacity. Right? Does anybody watch? Nobody watch that? Okay. All right. Anybody watch the Spelling Bee this weekend at all? Catch any of the Spelling Bee? What? Good. Awesome. Me neither. I didn't watch it either. What kind of loser would watch that? I mean, that's awesome. Spelling Bee is awesome. I love that stuff. That's the kind of guy I am. God works tenaciously. All right. Let me wrap this up. As I mentioned earlier, I believe that David's decision, I talked about this before, I just need to set the stage for this last point. David's decision to go down to the land of the Philistines is ill-advised. I've made that point, right? Faithless, all of that stuff. I also stated earlier that most people don't believe that. Most people don't hold to that and see that. They think David's decision is a great demonstration of craftiness and ingenuity. However, as I said, or let me put it this way, as I come to the end of chapter 29, I am even more convinced of my take on chapter 27 than I was 2 weeks ago. Let me explain why. Let's reason together, okay? This is big living room, me and you. Big living room, we're having a coffee, okay? We're having a coffee, we're talking. If David If David going down to the land of the Philistines was heroic, remember all the words I used? I'll repeat them. Heroic, crafty, rational, strategic, logical, diplomatic, shrewd, daring, and instinctual. All words that I read in my study. All words that I said were ones that I came across that other commentators made. If David was all of those things back in chapter 27, then in my mind, what takes place here in chapter 29 could almost be seen as deserved or merited. However, if what he did in going down to the land of the Philistines was faithless, followed by 16 months of butt covering and deceit, trickery, then what we see here in its grandest display is the tenacious and overwhelming grace and mercy of God. It was David, remember, who wrote the following in Psalm 23, verse 6, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." Westside, I know I may be biased, but I don't want David to be the hero for Samuel. I don't want David to be the hero of anything. I think David sinned. And I think David lied. And I think David deceived. And I think David is in a jam. But here's what I also think. I think God's grace and mercy is bigger and farther reaching and more tenacious and stubborn than David's sin and deception. But here's another reason why I don't want to teach David as crafty and shrewd and daring and heroic. I don't want to do that because I don't think most of us can relate to that guy. I mean, if we were hanging out in the lobby and I said, "Hey, give me four words to describe yourself." Daring. I mean, shrewd. Right? Heroic. "I'm the most interesting man alive." Right? "Pop the top of the Dos Equis." Right? If you don't know what I'm talking about, just YouTube it. All right, you'll understand what I'm talking about. See, I don't think we relate to that guy. But, can we relate to a guy who screws up, who in his fear and faithlessness tries to take matters into his own hands? Can we relate to a guy who tries to cover up one bad move and makes three others in its wake? And Westside, can we relate to a guy who is absolutely dependent on the necessity of God's grace and mercy being far greater than his sin? Me too. I can relate to that, David. But here's the last reason I don't want to teach David like that. Westside, I don't want to teach that David because Jesus didn't come to save heroes. Heroes don't need Jesus. Jesus came to save the sick and the sinner. Jesus is the hero for Samuel. And his grace and mercy is never merited. Why? For if grace and mercy is merited, it is not grace and mercy. So if mercy follows you all the days of your life and it's not merited, how does it follow you? The goodness of God. I need to close. Chapter 28 and chapter 29 could not end differently. Remember last week how we ended? Dark supper, right? This woman who's a medium, right? Kills the calf, right? Bread. And Saul has his last supper and he departs in the darkness of the night. Remember that? Take a look at how chapter 29 ends. Chapter 29, there is no night at the end of chapter 29. Look at when David departs. I'll read the last two verses. "Now then, rise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord who came with you, and start early in the morning and depart as soon as you have light." Oh, don't miss this. So David set out with his men early in the morning. Redundancy is an important aspect of understanding scripture. The writer is redundant for a reason. So David set out with his men early in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines, but the Philistines went up to Jezreel. Couldn't end differently for David than it did Saul. We also left off last week with Jesus entering the darkness on our behalf. But he didn't stay there. Jesus doesn't stay in chapter 28. Jesus meets us in chapter 29. As we read in Mark's gospel, after Jesus entered the dark on the cross and was laid into the dark, the two Marys go to anoint the buried body of Jesus. And Mark writes this in Mark 16. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. And they were saying to one another, who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb? That's a great question. Really important question. And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back and it was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe. And they were alarmed. And he said to them, do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth. And that's my prayer today, that those five words are yours. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. He's not in 28. He's in 29. Jesus entered the darkness for us, but he didn't stay there. For when the sun had risen that morning, so too had the sun risen that morning. I close with Lamentations 3, 22 and 23. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Would you rise as we respond, please? If you're a guest here, we always respond to the teaching of God's word because God speaks to us through his word. We now respond to what he has said. For some of us, that is as simple as, I just got to worship. For some, it may be that and then something else, or something else and then worship. Maybe repentance. Maybe reconciliation. Maybe you just need to pray. Maybe there's something that resonates. Maybe you're missing God because you're flowing. You're crediting something else and you're not seeing God's work. Maybe it's a time of worship because God has been so utterly tenacious in his mercy to you. So we respond. Worship through song. Luke and the band's going to lead us. Worship through giving. Please, if this is your ministry, give to it so we can extend the ministry of Jesus here in the city. Worship through prayer. Pastor Chad, his wife Linda would love to pray with you. They'll be over by that exit sign. Then they'll just go out into the hallway with you to pray. Please, if you want to pray with somebody, pray with them. And then the table of remembrance. We want to remember Jesus. So when you're ready, if you're a follower of Jesus, come down. Take a piece of the bread, which is a symbol of Jesus' body broken. Dip it into the wine or the juice, whatever your conscience allows. The wine or the juice is a symbol of the blood shed. Do it as a time of remembrance because we never want to forget Jesus. Lives don't go well when we choose to forget Jesus. Let me pray for you and then the band will lead us. Father, thank you for this time. We love you much. Father, in the same way that you were tenacious coming after us, may we be people who are tenacious in our worship of you. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.